sailboats here beached on the ground from that previous storm. There's piles of debris all along the road that will become missiles during the high winds and will become battering rams when the storm surge enters into this area. So people are aware the businesses are boarded up, and there's lots of people who have heeded those evacuation orders to get out.
And Sean, where exactly are they going? Are there evacuation centers set up?
There are lots and lots of places nearby that people can go to, schools on higher grounds. A lot of people made the decision to evacuate by the highways, Nermeen, to go to Georgia or to go to inland in Florida. But there are options for people, and there's still maybe a little bit of time for people to take heed to evacuate. But I really want to stress that this is going to be a very, very serious event, especially for people along the beaches in Manatee County, Sarasota, Bradenton, and South.
Especially a time for a community radio station like WMNF to be such an essential provider of accurate information. We want to thank Sean Canaan for being with us, WMNF news director based in Tampa, but he's now reporting live for us from the beach in Gulfport, Florida. We will continue to do coverage of this storm in the coming days. This is Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Another politician sitting far away. This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity, and inclusion. If your business aligns with these values, underwriting on KBOO is an effective way to reach an engaged audience. Take advantage of the best rate and audience in Portland by going online to kboo.fm/underwriting. That's kboo.fm/underwriting.
Ayo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Industrial streets, class lines, money talks, turning language to paper pieces, rich man's war, free man society, raging violent insecurity, nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act, rich man's war, Pershing's cruising Europe, America, Russia, governmental nuclear views. Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. 3 Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war. The poor starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war. With machines for ancestors, new unborn generations, chemical umbilical cords are only wiring. In your electrical progress, human lives burnt offerings to the god greed. With lies for ancestors, there is no truth in some futures. Rulers of minds feeding next generation souls to the control machine. Sacrifice ritual for the profit technology. With isolation for ancestors, there's only the present, bought by the credit material users. Forging chains binding you to destruction. The compliments of your deities, the industrial priest. Face who we really are. Some point we have no choice. Distant star, distant light. In real world, we are human being. In shadow of real world, we are being human. Neon mask for neon flash. Distant thunder, distant cloud. Passion's rain. Drenched in possession, what we take is hard to do. What we do is hard to take. Someone's are crazy, or maybe we take turns. Dreaming about some kind of life, we say it could have been different. But it wasn't, because we weren't. No matter what, it turns out the same. A lot of things we said weren't true. Industrial stories in an electric instant. Eon mask. Neon flash. Neon flash. Thing is, nihilistic desires. Civilized, gone insane. Didn't imagine it turning like this. Some things start good and go bad. Some things get bad and stay bad. Are we caught in between living a lie or not living at all? Eliminated choices, lost in dreams we let go. Memories we never got to have, something else to think about. Waking up in industrial society, surrounded by angry days. Going through motions of not being. Wanting the best but not expecting it. Surviving paid for in dreams. Feeling like a world alone. Serving God with the devil to pay. Feeling like something in no place. What goes on in hell anyway? Thing is, it has to do with heart. We have to understand what hearts are for before we can get back to heaven or paradise. Or the power in our mind.
Good morning. Thank you for indulging me in playing most of that cut by John Trudell. Rich Man's War from AKA Graffiti Man, 1992, with the great Jesse Ed Davis on guitar in the Graffiti Band. I am Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Rich Man's War, always war, always war. And didn't Trudell know it? And here we are on stolen land from the Native American people who lived here from time immemorial on the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. And we are joined by our second Wednesday guest or co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, citizen of the Diné or Navajo Nation from her mother and into the Yangtze Dakota ancestry from her father, a locally Portland area based native journalist and writer. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. And my dad's family are all Yankton and Sioux, and I guess I qualify to enroll too. So, yeah.
Okay, can you be a double citizen?
It depends on the tribe. Some tribes allow it, some don't. My tribes don't allow it, so that's what my parents had to choose. But I just wanted to make clear that my Yankton ancestry is not like 200 years ago. It's like all around me.
No, right. No, actually, when I wrote that, I was thinking, is that an awkward way to put it? But thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, no, I'm not 167,000 Yankton. I actually, my parents had to choose when I was young, and then they chose to go with the Navajo Nation.
That's an interesting thing. I never actually thought of that, and I don't think we've talked about that. Can you be like, interesting? Because
it depends on the tribe, you know. I've actually had a friend who was disenrolled from one of his tribes because his parents double enrolled him.
Oh.
And although he saw that as sort of a political thing, but. Yeah.
Clearly, though, you can be a dual citizen of a indigenous or native nation and the United States. So I guess you would be a triple citizen if you enrolled in two indigenous.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've been looking at possibly our kids are enrolled in the Navajo Nation, and we've been looking at enrolling, also seeing if we can enroll them up in Canada. Well, my husband is at Six Nations. So we'll see how that goes.
And how about, it brings up another question. So how about marriage? Do you, there's no like getting citizenship from your spouse?
No, that doesn't exist. I mean, maybe in some cases, like historically, obviously it was different. But of course, you know, part of the issue of, is acculturation. I mean, nowadays, the way those kinds of relationships are used for basically capitalism, for monetization schemes, you know, to monetize the claim, a very white, you know, Anglo perspective on it. You know, sort of like, you know, a lot of what, John Trudell talked about, you know, is the sort of white mindset where everything that is sacred to us turns into some sort of monetary money-making scheme, you know?
Right.
And so they turn these relationships with us into, you know, careers, you know, where they are making money off of it. And that's been really unfortunate to see. But of course, back in, you know, you were living on the Great Plains in 1700 and you were living your entire life with a Yankton, Yangtze Dakota band of people, you know, there's no other culture you would really be a part of, Jimmy, and you would have to acclimate to it, right? In a profound way that doesn't happen now, you know, because dominant society is white society, and even on my dad's reservation, they're outnumbered by white people, right? Mm-hmm. So my dad's tribe's land was allotted out, and the Allotment Act, which was to turn Indian tribes from communal people into, you know, land-owning white farmers. But it ended up happening is that a lot of the land was lost to white farmers who moved in and took the land. And so my dad's, the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, the majority of the population are white people. So my dad grew up being subjected and still this way, subjected to racism, to violence. My grandfather was beaten to death by the white police, right? So it becomes, you know, a way of continuing to enforce their inferiority, their enforced abuse of Native people. I mean, my dad said that he was arrested when he was a young man just because there was a blizzard and they needed people to shovel the snow. They would just go arrest all the Indian men in town and put them to work.
Sounds like Jim Crow.
Yeah, they call South Dakota the Mississippi of the North, you know, and so it was quite, I mean, this idea that someone could marry into the tribe, they're a total white person, right, but they somehow, you know, their privileges and their cultural capital as a white person doesn't actually outweigh that relationship in a meaningful way, you know? And I think, I think there was an example he's my first cousin, Philip Deloria. He's a professor now at Harvard. And I saw him years ago speak at Stanford when his book Playing Indian came out. And he was talking about how his grandmother, who was white, and had married his grandfather, who was my grandmother's uncle. His name was Brian Deloria Sr. He was an Episcopal minister. But he had gone to school back east, and he had married a girl from a very wealthy, prominent family, white family back east, Episcopalian family. And so her out in the Great Plains with her Indian husband, she looked down on the white people there because they weren't of the same culture and social class that she was used to, But also, she was able to demand special privileges from the church itself, the Episcopal Church, build her, a house with indoor plumbing and all. But she was able to use her whiteness in ways to provide for her family, right? And that would not have happened if he had married an Indian woman.
Mm-hmm. Of course. So
I think people don't realize how much whiteness gives them. We're actually developing a wealth quotient that takes that into account. We're doing genealogy work and stuff. It's quite profound. It really is, and it is to this day.
And of course the story you're telling of the situation of the Yankton people and the obviously a situation of total occupation, which we're going to be talking a little bit later in the program about Palestine, which we've talked about in the past, and obviously a deep historical connection, understanding. And it's always hard, it's hard for people who don't have that historical connection to realize how, I don't know, it always just boggles my mind to think of we have land acknowledgments and a lot of people are getting aware. And then, there's films like Killers of the Flower Moon, which do show something of that history on a popular culture sphere.
Although all the criticisms of it,
yeah, I know. But I'm just saying it does give something of a window, but not sufficient. But anyway, the reality of actual colonization looked like and continues to look like in this country. And I think I think that's one thing that I value of having you on and getting these perspectives is to continue to have that, be confronted with that ongoing reality and the history, because it's very profound, and then things like what's happening in Palestine do bring it up. Anyway, we're going to be talking about a direct connection. There's the Red Nation organization, which is an indigenous organization that works on a lot of different issues. They have had since 2 weeks after the war started in October of last year. Now we're marking a year of genocidal bombing and destruction in Gaza, and now extending into Lebanon and beyond. Anyway, there's a indigenous solidarity with Palestine letter signed by 1,122 indigenous workers, students, artists, politicians, and academics who've joined the movement to support Palestinian liberation. Anyway, we're going to be talking about later in the program. First, you have a article coming out in the San Francisco Chronicle about some heinous comments made recently by Trump and Elon Musk, which obviously not just limited to them, but since he's running for president and Elon Musk is such a massive, strangely massive public figure, and now throwing his weight and financial support to it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on that, on what how the Trump, how a Trump administration, a second Trump administration, might actually impact Native Americans.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to some points you made earlier. I didn't want to interrupt you, so I'm going to have to go back, dial it back a little bit. So, yeah, I think part of the question about colonization is what, how do we confront it, right? And I would actually like to bring up some of the, I think we've discussed this in previous episodes years back during election years, is the issue of the importance of the Native vote, right? And I did send you a link to an article I had written back in 2018, looking, which has a detailed breakdown, numerical breakdown. In fact, truth, I had to hire a statistician to go through all of my numbers to double check. So, and really looking at that election year, that and the role of the Native vote in electing. So, what research that's been done, particularly by the National Congress of American Indians, and they have a whole white paper on this on their website. But the Native vote has historically been sort of a deciding vote in rural areas, right? Because it is the blue spot in these red states. But indeed, these red states do tend to be purple. Like the urban areas are Democratic, and the rural areas are red. But within these rural areas are Native communities, and these tend to be blue, right? Almost always blue, except maybe in the South in Oklahoma. And so what you have is you have a number of senators who owe their seats to that vote. Of course, the most famous being Alaskan Senator Murkowski. She ran as an independent after the Republican Party wouldn't. She lost the primary, and the Alaska Native vote is what put her into the Senate, right? And then there's other senators. Of course, both of the Arizona senators. The Native vote is crucial, right? And I did a bunch of math on that in the 2018 piece I did called Native Voters Made Decisive Impact on Elections in Battleground States. Several Democratic victories were due in large part to the Native vote. And I break that down and also break down the Navajo vote in northern Arizona county by county. So there are about three counties in Arizona and then another county in New Mexico and in Utah. And But right now this year, of course, we have Senator John Tester, who is also owes his seat to the Native vote in Montana. In 2012, I wrote that he won by just 3,562 votes, right? And then, of course, famously, Heidi Heitkamp had also won less than 3,000 votes in D.C., in North Dakota. Former Senator Tim Johnson of South Dakota in 2002 won by 500 votes with the final ballots coming from the Pine Ridge Reservation, right? And then Murkowski, of course, ran as a write-in candidate and won with the Native Alaskan vote. So you can see with these very slim margins, and I think that Sinema won with just, I think, 53,000 votes. And of that, about 40,000 were from the Navajo Nation. So you can see how the Native vote can be the kind of put the thumb, they can be the deciding vote, basically. And but there are Native people who question, the importance of voting. And of course, we have had the late Cleveland Ollie on the show, and he was not a supporter of voting because he felt that it was not, that it was being part of the system, the colonial apparatus. And so there's some give and take there about the importance of the vote, and I just wanted to address that really quickly. And so with Elon Musk, what people were forwarding me, this was in early September that he tweeted out this thing it was a clip from a John Stossel show, right, TV show, and it's him interviewing some really right-wing historian guy who is basically claiming that that Native people are not as eco and all this eco-friendly. It's like a whole, just a romantic vision of Native people. And he's doing this basically to try to attack liberals and to accuse them of Marxism, but at the same time promoting really negative stereotypes about Native people, right? You know, and so there's ways in which, you know, I think Native Americans play into, you know, the larger ideas about what America's supposed to do. And actually bringing up my my cousin Philip DeLoria's book again, Playing Indian, he goes through that whole history systematically from colonial times to, I guess, when he wrote it in the late 20th century. And but yeah, the use of Native people as a prop for or a cudgel for different colonial viewpoints is definitely there. And you know, he's equivocating Marxism with a diverse Native sociocultural history they know next to nothing about means both sides of settlers are using stereotypes of Native people that do not in the end help Native people or promote understanding. And and then at the same, looking at, you know, Trump saying that he wanted one night of police brutality to stop crime in the country. And he came up with that around the same time. And it's just like, you know, in a country where we have historically low crime rates right now, it just, you know, brings up more images of sort of, you know, Hitler's beer garden push, you know, or, you know, trying to, like, really intimidate the population into submission and also political submission to what would be basically an autocracy. But
well, I'm looking,
and then Trump did.
Well, let's go back to Musk. I just saw this tweet, worth reading Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me.
Yes.
By Will, I don't know who by who, but, and then John Stossel. What's that?
Yeah. Wiley. His name is Wiley.
And then John Stossel, he's retweeting or whatever. John Stossel saying, in school, students are now taught that Native Americans were peaceful. Then uniquely evil Europeans arrived. Yeah, and then political professor, science professor, whoever that is, Wiley, says it's Marxism's fault, which is, I mean, there's so much to unpack there, this whole continued use of Marxism to, you know, this blanket term for anyone that they don't like that wants to oppose what they're trying to do. But anyway, that whole trope, as you're talking about, going back to, you know, this whole issue of, you know, trying to claim that you know, colonialism wasn't a bad thing, because really the natives were savages and they needed to be civilized. I mean, that's the subtext or the whatever.
Yes. Yeah. No, they say that explicitly, and yeah. They say that that everyone has benefited. And I do question that, because, of course, you know, progress, you know, the myth of progress and settler colonialism, you know, they say that it raised all ships. That's what they say in the piece. And Wiley calls it an obvious objective reality, and which is not so obvious, because he's running on a very low information sort of platform there. And yeah, I mean, when you look at the fact that, you know, even today, 30% of Navajo people don't have running water, right, or electricity. And yet, you know, rural white America was electrified and everything in the 1930s by then, I mean, almost 100 years ago. And yet Native nations in this country have been overlooked, we have largely bankrolled and funded this whole revolution of technology and development through our resources and other, you know, cultural contributions. And these are two men who really don't know a lot about the things they're talking about, yet with a man like Elon Musk, who is, I guess, the richest man in the world, who is from South Africa, right? A country that was in his lifetime still practicing segregation, or what do they call it? I can't remember right now. But, you know, it's just, he's coming into this country with this perspective, and we don't know how much of it was really formed by this sort of, you know, colonial perspective. both British and Afrikaner.
Well, a deeply racist perspective, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so, and he doesn't know anything about Native people yet. He's going to use them, and these Natives are some of the most, you know, vulnerable communities in the country, the poorest by any measure, right? And so it's quite, you know, to use Native people this way to, in order to push a point between two colonial sides, right? So that's what I am addressing, and then looking at Trump, and then Trump, of course, later saying that he was going to, first, he's making promises to certain tribes, or a state tribe in North Carolina, a state-recognized tribe, that he's going to get them recognized. They're quite a Republican community. They weren't able to go to meet the standards through the Office of Federal Acknowledgement because they couldn't prove they had any ties to the tribes they were claiming.
So basically he was trying to win a sector of votes, yeah, in a crucial battleground, yeah, state. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, but, you know, he's never actually talked about what he's going to do for tribes in his next presidency, if it happens. And, you know, he has a 16-page summary of the Republican platform on his website, his campaign website, but there are no mention of tribe, Native, or Indigenous. But what he does talk about are energy projects, right? In this platform, they state, common sense tells us clearly that we must unleash American energy if we want to destroy inflation and rapidly bring down prices. Build the greatest economy in history, those are capitalized. Revive our defense industrial base, fuel emerging industries, and establish the United States as the manufacturing superpower of the world. Those are also the first letters capitalized, manufacturing superpower of the world. The platform says, we will drill, baby, drill, which those words are totally capitalized, and we will become energy independent and even dominant. And the dominant is also capitalized again. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what he's saying. And, you know, one of the things I wrote about, too, when he came into office, I wrote about his first Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, right, who explicitly, when he entered office, said that his goal, and the Department of the Interior oversees tribes, right? And right now we have Deb Haaland, a Laguna Pueblo woman, former congresswoman from New Mexico, who heads that department. She's the first Native woman to do so, and, you know, oversee a large part of the country, right? A lot of the BLM, the public lands, and waterways and everything, and tribes. And so he came to office. He was from Montana, and he stated that his goal was to basically turn tribes into corporations. So instead of being sovereign nations, we would be corporations. And in my book, Stand Up, I do write a lot about that, because, you know, the origin story of colonialism is through corporations. They kind of grew up together because, as I noted in my book, you know, corporations were created to fund these, exploration and colonization abroad, because the crown could not afford to do it. So instead, subjects came together, and the crown as well, and formed corporations and all took, shared the risk in these and the profit.
Yeah.
And so these corporations, you know, like the Massachusetts Bay Company, the Virginia Company of Adventures in London, you know, all of these were the ones that initially started the first colonies in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I just want to remind people that this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your weekly host, Paul Rowan. I have my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, on today, and we're talking about a number of things, including the upcoming elections and what the Trump side has been saying about Native Americans. Not saying much, but the few things, the few clues don't. And also, as you're talking about his first administration, hopefully his last, but how that indicates. We're also talking about the Native vote and how crucial that is in some states, especially the more rural states. And this is a call-in show, and you are invited to call in and talk with me and my host, Jacqueline Keeler, at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Yeah, I wanted to just hark back because this is actually the first time. This is actually a pretty recent book, this Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me by Wilfred Riley, Debunking the False Narratives Defining America's School Curricula. And talk about the culture wars. And, you know, the way that Native peoples have played into the, as you talk all the time about the narratives, false and otherwise, of these United States, how they play into the culture wars. It seems like it's often somewhat hidden or oblique, although it does come sometimes erupt into more explicit things. Kind of the hidden the way really people really think, or the way the system really operates, as you outline, as you've just been talking about. Anyway, there's another book I just wanted to mention, the People's History, Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States, came out many decades ago, and some flaws, but it really is a kind of an unmasking of the dominant historical narrative, a really kind of a masterwork. And there's a right wing counter to that. I forget the actual name of it, but it's like it's the Right Wing People's History of the United States, which is like a major salvo in this, like this, the intellectual or pseudo intellectual side of the culture wars. Anyway, it's really, really important that the way that this whole, I don't know, the way that this the culture wars continued to play out, and the way the way the right wing is weaponizing these things in turning back the real if we're talking about progress, the real progress that has been made in actually starting to teach that real history, and the suppressed and marginalized and oppressed voices. That if you look at, there's been analyses of the way history was taught up until really the 1960s. There started to be cracks in it, through the movements of the 60s. And a lot of the people, what the right wing hates most, and a lot of the fuel that comes, both monetary and ideological, propels the culture wars, has been in reaction to that shift that was beginning to happen. A lot of the people who came of age in the 1960s actually did go into some of the teaching professions and actually applied, the lessons that they learned in terms of actually really looking at the reality, the real original sources and the original voices that had been suppressed and marginalized. And so I've talked about this a lot. The right wing reaction to the 1960s we're still living through, and books like this, Lies My Liberal Teacher Told Me. Anyway, I just want to say that.
Yeah, I think it's obviously there's a they're fighting like crazy because there's going to be a demographic shift that will really make it into to a minority or just another group, right? I'm looking at some of his previous books. And they include Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Telling a Fake Race War, and Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. So, yeah, he's got a theme.
No, that they don't want you to talk about.
Yes, I know. Well, but, I think he's talking about sort of, what do they call that when you're not allowed to say racist things anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that.
Yeah.
So, while we wait for someone to call in, 503-231-8187, you're welcome to continue along the themes we've been talking about. We also wanted to bring up that the horrific, it's just mind-bogglingly horrific, and the I don't know, it's just this moment is really, really driving a lot of us a little batty, that this period where the Israeli government under Netanyahu and his right-wing allies are just using this moment to just demolish demolish whatever infrastructure of opposition to their rule. That's really what they're doing. Has been able to assert itself despite this long history of domination, marginalization, open air confinement, political prisoners, suppression of journalists, killing of journalists, etc., and the solidarity expressed. Anyway, it was one thing we can talk about as long as well as the rest, and be interesting to hear what other people say. But yeah, I know you've written about this. You talked about this man that was a really important Native American figure at Dartmouth College, who is in the first round, one of the earlier rounds of suppression of academics for their expressing solidarity with Palestine. He was one with the early movement, beginning of the boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS movement, and how 170 leading Native American scholars had also signed a petition urging their organization. Then the people were accused of anti-Semitism, and he got hit by that. Anyway, looks like we do have a caller, but maybe just start talking about that connection between, of indigenous solidarity for Palestine. Go ahead. Hello? Uh-oh. Are you there, Jackie?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I thought we had a caller.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We misunderstood. Let's just go to our caller. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
This is Camilo. How are you?
Good. Hi, Camilo.
I've been away for a while. But I'm enjoying this conversation because it's in tune with two things that I'm reading right now. I'm reading the Ibis trilogy by Amitav Ghosh, and I'd say he is really one of the leading writers who discusses the issues of colonialism and empire. And I think the really interesting case of what's happening with Ta-Nehisi Coates right now really is propelling this concern to the media and examining how the media has failed to explore what the truths that we're discussing in this program are about.
So I missed talking about, you're saying there's been a big reaction against his recent book. I did watch the
message.
Yeah, right. I did watch on the TV version of Democracy Now! Yesterday, where he was on and he was mentioning, they showed a clip of a CBS morning program where they, so what's going on with how widespread is that reaction against his new book?
Well, I don't know how widespread the reaction is, but I think the reaction is causing the media to give him a lot more space. And you can go on YouTube and find a lot of Ta-Nehisi Coates videos. Uh-huh. And there's one other thing that I wanted to mention in the media, and that is a podcast called Empire. And it's a podcast that goes all the way back to looking at the foundation of the British East India Company, and certainly the origin of capitalism right there.
Yeah, I love
it's
this
just,
kind of yeah.
Convergence of a lot of interests that I have that are the theme for today's show, that I wanted to bring in these different media and authors that I've just mentioned.
Okay. Well, thank you, Camille.
Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to check all those out. And I'm looking at the Empire podcast page, and I see that a day ago they had a one called Native American Chiefs, the Founding of Canada and the KKK, Scots in America. So that looks really interesting. Yeah, that sounds really up what I really want to look at. And I'm also eager to read more of Amitav Ghosh's stuff. Ta-Nehisi Coates, sort of backlash, and then I think it has. I really have to say that I admire him for writing it and standing up, and he was saying, in an interview I heard of him, I think on NPR, he was saying how he, when he went there to, he knew about, he heard different sides of the story from different journalists he respected over the years, but when he finally went to Palestine, to Gaza, he saw, when he saw how people were living, it just reminded him immediately of the Jim Crow South. I mean,
yes.
It was just a very visceral experience, and you know, and I think also, you know, other Black writers have written about that in the past as well, that reaction, and yeah, I think it's so. Yeah, I wrote a piece back in 2017 for my alumni magazine, Dartmouth Alumni Magazine, about a member of the Huma tribe who is a dean at Dartmouth and who, full disclosure, also taught me. He was my professor of Indian federal law, and also was a Native American program director when I was there as an undergraduate. And he was up for dean of faculty, which is a very prestigious position at Dartmouth. And he would have, the first Huma tribal member to have that position. And, it was derailed because as secretary of the, Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, NASA, I think, in 2013, he had signed a letter that as a secretary of the organization to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel, and this was used by a Native Studies professor there who is Jewish, he really studies Alaskan Natives, Sergei Khan. And he was also a member of NASA. You don't have to be Native American to be a member, but he was quite outraged by this letter and the vote to support it by 170 leading Native scholars, and so he used this opportunity basically to get back, and he basically organized a lot of the Jewish alumni and students to protest due to his appointment. And due to basically, he gave it up. He's still dean, but he's not dean of faculty. And so I wrote this piece. I was asked to write this piece, and I basically had to do a lot of research on the history of this. I looked at some of the things I cite in here. What the Israeli Constitution used to guarantee, rights, equal rights, but that has actually been since removed from the Constitution, and basically now Palestinians are actually formally second class citizens.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Camilo.
Goodbye.
And
okay.
503-231-8187. If you want to join the conversation, like Camilo did, we only have about 10 minutes left, so you better get in right now if you want to join in.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it did go by fast. So yeah, this whole issue of the whole issue of free speech is very fascinating, because clearly the people who seem to most vociferously talk about free speech, like Elon Musk and some of the right-wing demagogues, they actually don't really want free speech. They want their kind of free speech, and because if they did believe in free speech, they would not be clamoring for the suppression of pro-Palestinian voices in academia and elsewhere, like they're doing. And what this article you're pointing out in this particular episode that happened now,
about seven years ago.
Is going on with a vengeance now.
Yes, can I read a little bit from it? Just a little bit, because I think it reviews it pretty well. Far from being an isolated incident, Duterte's action must be viewed in the context of the broad support given to the BDS movement by academics across the country. BDS support is not limited to the other 11 NASA council members who signed the statement. the Venerable American Studies Association, the oldest and largest association devoted to American studies, and Publishers of American Quarterly also passed a resolution supporting BDS. Another marginalized ethnic group, the National Association of Chicana and Chicano Studies, gave unanimous support to a resolution in favor of a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. Are their members now all ineligible for career advancement? The numbers are astounding, and the impact of such a standard on the future of scholarship in this country and who has the right to participate in it is immense. In addition to these academics, 52% of United Auto Workers Local 2865, which represents 15,000 student workers at the University of California, pledged to carry out the academic boycott of Israel. Of course, its reprisal for supporting the BDS movement for Palestinian rights is not equally applied. This punishment then in practice is applicable only to Dutu at the time, a scholar of a small and often overlooked minority group. A quick look at the stated goals of BDS to end Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and give full equality to Palestinians living in Israel and the right of return to Palestinian families shows support for a corrective course for governmental mistreatment of the Palestinian people. These rights are fundamental and guaranteed by international law. Yet those demanding Dutu's resignation apply a false conflation of anti-Semitism with measures meant to hold the Israeli government accountable for its policies. The 2014 United Nations International Court of Justice issued an advisory opinion finding that Israel's West Bank barrier wall violated international law. The call for a BDS movement arose from Palestinians after the United States vetoed a United Nations resolution condemning the 400-mile-long wall. It has divided and isolated Palestinian communities from water sources and olive tree groves. One town is entirely encircled by fencing. The barrier has amounted to a de facto land grab for Israel because 85% of it is on Palestinian land, allowing Israel to take control of an area the size of Chicago. All the while, Israeli settlements in the West Bank continue to grow.
And that's the background that the many forces are trying to keep suppressed. The background for what happened on October 7th of last year, when Hamas made this brutal incursion into Israel. And everyone wants to just talk about that as a starting point, but we are talking about this background for both the Hamas action and for Israelis' tremendously brutal response to it, and this cynical seizing of this the election time to carry out this massive suppression of any kind of resistance to Israelis' domination, anyway, and it's a really terrible moment. I'm not sure how it's going to play out. Of course, it is playing into the election, and the Harris-Biden total inaction, total inability, total paralysis in reaction to this the immensity of what of the assault that's going on by Israel is not doing them any favors, I think. Anyway, what's your take?
Yeah, and there are. It was at I can't remember if it was Politico or The Intercept, but they had done a bunch of interviews with Jewish Americans who have lost their jobs for supporting Palestine. Mm-hmm. And it's happening quite. It's not just Dutu anymore. I should say that is not the case anymore. But it certainly felt that way back in 2017. That a Native scholar was being, because he had no one to stand up for him. I mean, because mm-hmm. we're such a minority that we're the first to lose our jobs over it. Do you mean?
Yeah. So. No. I hadn't actually focused enough on that article you wrote, because we've talked about this in the past, but that's the article being the Dutu, that's Dutu, dilemma in the wake of the controversy over the appointment of Bruce Dutu, a class of 80 Dartmouth as Dean of Faculty, a Native American alumna worries about the fate of indigenous activism in academia, from the Dartmouth Alumni Magazine in 2017. We are still have about 5 minutes left. Looks like we may not get any more callers. But yeah, I don't know, this moment, I don't know if, this letter again that went out, Indigenous Solidarity with Palestine letter, and I'm sure there's other initiatives going on that happen to be from the Red Nation organization. But once upon a time, there was, you don't hear much about like international Indigenous solidarity. Not that one ever did, but maybe it's because I used to be very immersed in that world, and including having gone to Geneva to the United, the working group on Indigenous populations. But there used to be, at least on a certain scale, a really vibrant, and I'm sure it's there, but I guess you just, I don't know, where is that at in terms of, you know, the whole, like solidarity, cross global Indigenous solidarity being something of a factor. Maybe it just never really was much of a factor. I don't know.
Well, there's been a lot of it. I mean, I think, there's even a website, indigenousforpalestine.org, you know, and of course the International Indian Treaty Council has issued support for, has called on Israel and the Biden administration to support the rights of the Palestinian people. There's IITC board member Lisa Ballinger. She's Leech Lake Ojibwe in Dakota. She said, as a mother and grandmother, I'm horrified to see weapons of war killing innocent children, women, babies, while those who have the greatest powers in the world watch and do nothing. And I see Cultural Survival has an article from Pine Ridge to Palestine, already in the ceasefire movement. This is an interview with Nick Tilson, who runs the Indian Collective, mm-hmm. and who is also, his father is Jewish as well. His father was a Jewish American attorney who worked for the tribe and married into the tribe. I think his brother is the poet Mark Tilson. It does exist, you know.
I guess I was maybe thinking of, I don't know, I don't want to make this like my own personal reactions. I guess I was thinking of the how those things grew out of, you know, the heyday of the Red Power movement in the American Indian movement, where, you know, had the big occupations and there was a feeling that a feeling of like basically that they weren't able to gain any justice under the colonial administration of the United States. So they went to the United Nations to, just the way that Palestinians go to the United Nations, and we see how much effect that's had. And you know, there have been some.
I wrote a piece about that. Uh-huh. I wrote a piece in 2017. I went to United Nations. I was sponsored by this organization, and you meet a bunch of tribal leaders. This was on the 10th anniversary of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and some of the leaders described it as, you know, they were kind of walking on the yellow brick road. I'm interviewing a famous Onondaga leader. I'm forgetting his name right now.
Orrin Lyons? Yes,
I was interviewing Orrin Lyons, and he was saying that they were like on the yellow brick road. They really thought this was going to lead to something, but it didn't. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And but I see this website, Indigenous Solidarity of Palestine, and they quote another a Dakota scholar I really respect, Elizabeth Cook Lynn. She was related through marriage to my Keeler side, and then also she was really a great mentor to me. She died recently. She's a settler historian. This website says, settler historians of the United States have long framed the history of U.S. settler colonialism as a, quote, conflict between two equal sides, cowboys and Indians, settlers and savages. Dakota scholar Elizabeth Cook Lynn reminds us there are no two sides to a story of colonial dispossession and genocide. There is a clear perpetuator, the settler state. Settlers invade and destroy in order to replace. Like the U.S., Israel is a violent settler nation. So that's kind of neat to see Elizabeth Cook Lynn quoted there. But I think that clearly shows there is a lot of indigenous support there.
Mm-hmm. I guess I guess I'm just feeling the powerlessness of the moment, which, you know.
I think it's amazing that, you know, so this discussion is so widespread. I mean, it's not just the students anymore. It's not just, I think it's, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you really how much the average person on the reservation understands this issue. Obviously, these folks, most of the folks leading this are academics, Native academics, and social media personalities. But I think that they're, I would be curious to go on the reservation and ask people what they think, see what their perspective is, how they understand it. But certainly solidarity with Palestine has been a long, ongoing thing with Native activism, definitely going back to the 1970s, right? And I one of the pieces I wrote for the San Francisco Examiner way, way back in the late 90s was after the death of another mentor of mine. She died in Colombia, and she was married to a Palestinian man. She was a Menominee. And,
I'm sorry, I can't let you go on with that because it's going to be too long a thought. No, it's just going to be too long a thought, and we're totally out of time. But thank you once again, Jacqueline Keel. Yeah. Really appreciate it. All right, and we got to take off. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1930,